this is the Living Legacy Project interview with Patty Wallace on April 21st, 2014. And Patty, thank you so much for coming in today to participate in this project. And to get right into it, can you talk a little bit about what inspired you to want to be an artist or to pursue a career in the arts?
Yeah, I guess I never really thought of doing anything else, but I grew up in a very cultured family. Parents were into theater and used to take us to plays and always took ballet classes and started me off at art school right in the beginning. And we used to walk to the Albright Knox Art Gallery, and I was really interested in other cultures because my father's a scientist and he worked at Roswell Park, and everyone he worked with were from other parts of the world, and I was just fascinated by their culture. And we'd go to dinner at their houses and we'd have their food and listen to their music, and it was just, so I think basically I did think about this and I thought, you know, it's really my parents. You know, they really encouraged me. We always had books and artwork up, and aesthetics were important, and history. So I think that's pretty much what inspired me. Also, when I was little, I used to draw in my father's books that were passed down, antique books. I used to draw in the end papers of these antique books. And finally, they got a clue and got me some paper so I wouldn't, like, ruin all their antique books. But I think having books around, really, with all these great illustrations, I remember just, like, staring at them and playing with them. Cartoons, too. Mm-hmm. Saturday morning cartoons. I loved them. Especially the really old ones, like from the 20s. Uh-huh. Yeah.
When you were a kid, did you see yourself wanting to be an artist, or did you just knew you wanted to, like, do something creative and fun?
I wanted to do something creative and fun. I used to think that I'd like to be an actress because I was a ham, and I got attention. You know, I wanted attention that way, so I wanted to entertain. So I think of art as a form of entertainment. And when I went to acting school, I enjoyed it, but I discovered I really wasn't a very good actress. I was better at directing. Mm-hmm. I was more visual. And now I could probably act because I have more confidence. But back then I thought I would rather direct. I'd rather have, you know, tell people where to stand and how to light. So I think that being allowed to play when you're young, I was in the Buffalo Theater Workshop, and you had to audition for that. That's a good example of why the government should really step up and help fund youth programs, because that was sponsored by New York State. They don't have that around anymore. It was like, you know, an arts foundation. And it provided opportunities for kids who couldn't otherwise afford to participate in these things after school. So that really, a lot of people who came from the Theater Workshop are really famous now. Christine Baranski, for example, she's an actress that she was one of the older ones. I was the youngest one. And Tom Fontana, writer, St. Elsewhere, you know, so gives kids an opportunity. It's amazing what they can do. Great opportunity. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
As you went through sort of like your adolescence and that sort of thing, were there other opportunities of after school programs or other sorts
yes.
of events?
Yes. Guess where it was? At Buff State.
Uh-huh.
They used to have classes here free where our teachers, our students, would practice on kids if they wanted to come for class, and they were free. I used to get on a bus, take the Grant Street hurdle bus to Grant, and walk over here, and I learned so much. We didn't have art in my school. We had a little bit of art. Went to a Catholic school. We had a little bit of art and music. I liked music a lot, too, but we just didn't have the opportunity provided to us through the school. And I had a blast. We met a lot of other people who were from all over Buffalo, the area, but I thought that was a great opportunity. And the Police Athletic League on Austin Street used to have art classes. So any time there was an art class, my parents would put me there. Albright Knox on Saturdays, they had the Saturday thing. I was always involved somehow with whatever we could get our hands on.
You're very much a product of the art scene in Buffalo in many ways.
And also being married to Gary Nickard, mm-hmm. he's an artist and a musician, and he was the director of SEPA Gallery. So we met a lot of people. I mean, our house was a constant party. People would stay with us. I came home one day and William Wegman was sleeping on my couch. And I said, oh, that's nice. Who's this? And he goes, oh, that's Bill Wegman. He's just taking a nap. And I'm like, oh, cool. So, but what was nice is that a lot of these people, like Jim Welling, and these people later on, we became friends. So we had all these great connections. So we could kind of branch out and meet people. So that by the time we moved to New York, we knew a lot of the people from SIPA, from Buffalo, from that experience. And then, of course, through Hallwalls. Hallwalls mm-hmm. and SIPA were next to one another. So we were all kind of together.
Mm-hmm.
It was nice.
It's nice when you have a network that then can both like keep you rooted in the Western New York community, but also
yeah.
like spiral outwards
right.
and have these impacts far beyond.
And keep you up to date. You know, these grassroots groups are always new and fresh. You know, it's not like going into a mausoleum.
Mm-hmm.
And with a flashlight. This
mm-hmm.
is always something new and bright that opens up.
First, I'd like to talk more about maybe your earlier experiences with education and where you went to school,
mm-hmm.
maybe after high school, where you did your college experience.
Yeah, actually, I had a couple of high school teachers who were
mm-hmm.
really a great inspiration skill-wise.
Yeah.
They really taught you how to draw and paint and the elements and principles of design, and so how to get those tools and put things together. And they were old-timers. They were like these old guys that had worked in the ad industry in New York. They knew how to use airbrushes and stuff like that. So that was kind of cool. Everything was analog. There's no digital. It was analog. And I love the craft of things. I like making things and playing with things. And I think Gary is the one that really taught me the concept, how to go about making something out of it, you know, thinking about what does it mean, you know, what do you want to say. So when I went to Geneseo for my first year of college, and I took photography and painting and anthropology, because I also was thinking about anthropology and archaeology, because I love the idea of digging and finding treasures. I wanted to find treasures. And then I found out when I came back to Buffalo, I met some friends, Gary was going to UB, about media study. And I thought, oh, media study, filmmaking. I love film. I love movies. I could tell you everything about any genre of film. I just love film. So I said, I want to make movies. So I came back here and I went to UB and I studied with some great people. And I was lucky enough to have studied with Paul Sheritz, Hollis Frampton, and he was just a hoot. We'd have classes at like Sign of the Steer. And Brian Henderson was a great inspiration. I learned a lot about how to put pictures together. You know, lighting, looking at film, taking it apart, analyzing it. And Ernie Gehr, Jack Goldstein, oh my, I just wanted to be him. His work was just so transcendental. I mean, he just really, those guys were right on the cutting edge. You know, pun intended. Then, and as far as education, as far as photography and lighting, I learned a lot from Pat Bazelon. I had to make money somehow, so worked for her as an assistant. She photographed all the steel mills in Buffalo and the grain mills, and she's an architectural photographer mainly. Had a lot of big clients. And she and I are the ones that wanted to move to New York. She lived in New York. She's from England originally, but she wanted to back to New York. And we went back and worked at the Brooklyn Museum. And so she taught me just about everything about photography, about lighting, using hot lights, because she was in the film industry. So that and media study are what got me really good at lighting. I mean, that was a long time ago. There's new equipment and, you know, other techniques now. But I would say that, you know, working with somebody who is a professional is a really, really good way of learning how to do something. You know, cooking, painting. You have somebody lean over and show you, hey, you know what, instead of mixing black into gray, try gray into black. And you're like, wow, where were you? I needed you before this. So I think it's really important to work with people as long as they're willing to share
mm-hmm.
information with you.
Mm-hmm.
So,
here at the Birchfield, we have some really significant components of both Paul Sheritz's archive and Hollis Frampton's. Can you talk a little bit more about the role that either of them played in your early development or your work? Or?
Well, I think because Paul Scherz and Hollis are both about sequence, and I think we tend to be, by nature, literal, they kind of helped me become nonlinear at the same time. And fortunately, I worked with Marion Fowler. After Hollis passed away, I worked for her organizing his photographs, and so I had an opportunity to see all this other stuff that he had created. But I think that kind of time and sequence thing really is so filmic, and that really edged its way into my own work, and it influenced me, really. Same thing with Scherz. The thing I liked about Scherz was the sound, and so I was kind of torn. I was torn about, God, what do I want to do? There's so much. Do I want to make movies? Do I want to be a musician? Do I want to make clanking sounds and show passage of time? Should it be an illusion? And then I thought, you know what? Maybe we're taking this all too seriously. Maybe we should just have fun. And I took it so seriously. I was like so worried about what other people were going to think about what I was doing. And I think that you shouldn't second guess yourself. You just be yourself, and it just falls into place. If you're true to yourself, it's going to work. But I think it inspired me. And I was just thinking about Ernie Gehrt. Same thing with this film. And I think it must have been a movement at the time to show the illusion of time and sequence. You're asking me that, just like, oh my God, that makes sense. That's why I did what I did. It was all about the sequence stuff. One day, when I was taking a painting class, my teacher said to me, he says, you know what, you're trying to say too much in your painting. You should be a filmmaker. Because you're going to say so much. And I said, yeah, I guess you're right. So I wound up doing paintings of films, of movies. So I just kept going back and forth. What I would do is I would take pictures, and everything was about the television set then too. About the, everybody was into semantics and Levi-Strauss and all the philosophers and Derrida and Walter Benjamin. And so everything was all about, well, deconstruction was a big word. So let's all get into that. But it was fun in that you're learning something new. You don't want to be static. You want to keep moving. And I was lucky that I was, actually, when you think about it, because some people would say, why don't you get a job? Why don't you get a real job? I was like, to me, that's the hardest thing you could possibly do. Mm-hmm. I got A's or 4.0 in physics, and I'd get a 3.0 in art because it was just so hard to discipline yourself to think. And you're thinking beyond just black and white numbers. You know, it's deep. That's like the fourth dimension. I keep seeing this word over there on that sign. It says displacement. I think that's the other word that Hollis and Scherz were about, was displacement. Put one thing in exchange for another thing and create something else, and then it creates a story in motion. And I think that's kind of like what I like, is the idea of a story in motion.
Did you sort of experience that moving through the media study program and then starting to develop your career?
Well, I'd say that the main obstacle is being a woman. You would think by now it would have changed, but it really hasn't. It's an uphill battle for women. There's just no way. There's a bias. There's a bias in the art world. There's a bias in the fashion world. There's a bias everywhere. And it's real. I mean, if you look at Sotheby's and you look at the auctions, all these male artists are selling for millions of dollars, and there's maybe two females in that auction list, you know, and they're like Agnes Martin. And I don't even see George O'Keefe up there, you know, and there's hardly anybody new. They're great, incredibly, but they're just not taken seriously because they're women. It's still a very biased society. And so actually one of the other things I wanted to do was be a chef, because I like to eat and I like to cook and I like to create, because again, you entertain. So I like to please people because I want attention. I have a big ego and I need to be stroked all the time. No, but I like to make people happy. And so when my mother went back to work when I was about 11, she handed me Julia Child cookbook and said, hasta la vista, just make sure dinner's on the table by 7 or whatever. And I was like, okay. I said, if you bring me the ingredients, I'll cook it, because they saw that I took an interest in cooking. because my mother was a pretty decent cook, but my grandmother, I kind of grew up with my grandmother too. I'd stay with her when my parents worked, and she was an amazing cook. So we like pleasure. We like luxury. We like to enjoy. And we're not into the fast food, yes, if it's like greasy and salty and you just got to have it. But, you know, it's kind of what was like survival. So I thought, well, I would like to be a chef. So I started cooking, and I started cooking French stuff, and everybody raved about it and thought it was great because people don't. And, you know, back then, it was hard to get ingredients. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons why Gary and I, we say this, it's not true, but we say that one of the reasons why we left Buffalo was we couldn't find any fresh cilantro. So we said, that's it, we're out of here. We had to go all the way over to Grant Street to a Puerto Rican bodega to get cilantro. So we said, that's it, we're gone. When I was 19, I was invited by my father's former boss, actually it was his boss at the time, Dr. Harker, David Harker. He was the head of the crystallography department at Roswell Park, perhaps with Herb Hauptmann and all those guys. They all were on a team together. Well, his first wife, I transferred to Narden Academy when I was in seventh grade, and those kids had been learning French, and I didn't know French at all. And his first wife was a white Russian, was born within the Kremlin walls. Her father was he was the Attorney General to Tsar Nicholas. So she grew up in a royal setting, before the revolution, of course. And they spoke French. Russian was spoken maybe to your servant, but you didn't really speak Russian. Everyone spoke French, and this was because Peter the Great wanted to westernize Russia. And she spoke fluent French. They were here in Buffalo, and she offered to tutor me for free so that I could catch up to the other kids. And I would go once a week. This is how much just a little bit of help, and I tell my students this, 10 minutes of somebody helping you will make such a difference of anything, math, whatever you want to learn, Photoshop. For 1 hour, she would have me read from a French grammar book, kind of little French kids learn from, and then she would ask me questions and correct my pronunciations. And at the end, my reward was a glass of cranberry juice. By the time I got to high school and college, I was taking like third level French just because of this 1 hour a day. Well, she passed away. Dr. Harker remarried, and she always said, you've got to go to France. This is Mrs. Harker. Kate Harker, you've got to go to France. You'd love it. You'd love the history. You'd love the art. And she passed away, and then his second wife said, you know what? We would like for you to come and visit with us. And you can drive around with us, plan out our map. He was giving lectures all over France. In a way, those people were like a second set of parents to me. They were older. They would be more like my grandparents. Mm-hmm. And mega snobs. they were both like, came from very high families in California, and parents were doctors, but they were very, very cultured. So they taught me a lot, and they took me to all these places. I ate the most incredible food, and I thought France was the most incredible place. I said, I'm never going back to the States. Never. Just sell the kids, sell the house. I'm staying in France. Just to see the difference in the culture. And the aesthetic, how everything is so important. Even the poorest neighborhoods, people had gardens, beautiful gardens. You know, if they could have just a pot of flowers. And I thought that was great. So we went to all these places, and I was really into the Middle Ages when I was young. I know, probably from movies, I used to think that I was a princess and I was going to be rescued by a guy protecting me against a dragon or something like that. And I was really romantic about stuff like that. And I actually liked the Pre-Raphaelites. I loved the Pre-Raphaelites. I was like, oh, I want to be in that story. I just want to be one of those people. I guess now I'd be like a Harry Potter type person or whatever goth kids are into. Anyway, seeing this stuff, going into Chartres and seeing the windows and going into Notre Dame and going to see these castles, or Carcassonne in Toulouse, it's like, wait a minute. You go in my street, and it's like, oh, that was built in 1960. You go to Europe, and it's like, no, that was built in 1060. Oh, that's where the Visigoths poured boiling oil onto the Crusaders. You know, I mean, it's just was so enlightening. And going to southern France, I don't know if you've ever been to southern France, it was like around the Massif Central. I said, this looks like Cézanne's paintings. And they said, that's because this is where he painted, and the colors really do exist. I was like, this is amazing. That experience was just phenomenal, to see this, to expand and know that, you know, not to be provincial, my students, I tell them, stop taking pictures of your lockers. Get on a bus and go downtown. Go to the lake. You know, walk around the canal, take pictures. Get out. And the other thing I would tell people, too, is that wherever you are from, go away for a little while. Go away. You can always come back. Just don't burn your bridges, and then you can come back. And Buffalo has a big repatriation, or expats, I think they call it. No, it's not so bad here. Not now. It really is. I mean, you know, you have Wegmans. You don't need anything else. So one of the things I liked about living in Brooklyn, we lived in an Arabic neighborhood, and there were, like, Saudis and Palestinians and Egyptians, all different kinds of people. And they were not conservative. They were very liberal. It wasn't oppressive. And I was just telling my parents last night about this place we go into, and they give you a piece of pastry, like baklava or some kind of bird's nest. Say, come in, have a cup of tea. And the cats would be in there, and they'd have these big ovens, and you'd sit and talk. And I thought, what a great attitude to be community-minded. People would talk. They talk about politics, talk about food, their families. And I think, unfortunately, the way we live, when we live so far apart from one another, we don't get together and sit on a stoop and chat, find out what's going on in the world, or connect. But you know, we go in and say, Sammy, I'm making chicken tonight, or lamb. And he said, oh, okay, I'll mix you the spices. And then mix up all the spices, and then you'd have like these barrels of pickled lemons, preserved lemons. And now preserved lemons are all the rage, I noticed. Harissa, all these exotic things, but I loved that. I guess I just wanted to be... My favorite books, okay, my favorite movie, not because of the filmmaking or anything, but because of the story, is Out of Africa. I loved the idea of explorers, of adventurers. I love the idea of going to places like Africa or Asia or exotic places that haven't been, and seeing other people, seeing animals, you know, the smells. And I used to read, all the books I used to read were like about Stanley Livingston or Darwin. I mean, that to me is just blows my mind, you know, the discovery of evolution. And so that kind of inspired me. Mm-hmm. Funny thing, too, is guess what inspired me? Even though I'm not religious, I love a religion because I love the iconography. Mm-hmm. I love the pictures. I love the Indian. I think I'm more spiritual. I mean, I love the idea of St. Francis and, you know, helping the poor, but all about nature. It's my favorite quote is, you can see all of heaven in a wildflower. And I thought, well, that says it all. And he just said, don't put down this little bird because he's a common bird. Look at him. And they are beautiful. We just take so much for granted. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons why I got into that was my brother-in-law died. Well, a couple people died at the same time. He was an artist. Actually, he's in the collection here, Chris Nickhart. He died from AIDS. And fortunately, we had him around for a while so we could party and travel and have fun and celebrate. And he would be like the ever-ready battery, where all of a sudden you think, oh, this is it. We got a call from the hospital, and then all of a sudden I'm taking him to Key West, and we're like dancing on the dock. So, and Gary's taking him to Italy and all this stuff. So I think it kind of hit me when we came back from New York. I got really depressed because I thought, oh, I'm a failure. Came back because Gary got a job at UB and to take care of Chris. And things were just kind of petering out, and Gary's getting tired of New York. It's more fun to visit, unless you're a millionaire. And they ran out of things for me to photograph, so I said, okay, yeah, let's go back. My parents are there, my mother just really wanted me to come back. So Chris died, and I was dead on top of coming back. I got really depressed, and I just didn't know. Just a funk. I did some work, got some jobs. I taught at UB. I took Mary and Fowler's position for a semester, and then I taught foundations for a semester. And that was fun. Shot Ani DeFranco album cover via Ron, and did some other, you know, freelance stuff. And then I said, you know what? I think I need something. I'm getting older. I need insurance. So I need something that's more steady. So I said, I'm going to bite the bullet, and I'm going to go back to school and get my teaching certification. I already had my master's degree, so I didn't have to go through that. Now they have to go and get a master's in education. So I decided to do that, and I thought, well, you know, I had done work with SEPA when I came back, working with kids in schools, doing projects, like teaching them about careers, we did little photojournalism programs, and with mostly Buffalo City Schools. And that was fun. I said, yeah, I can do this. So then eventually I wound up getting a job. It took a while. There were no jobs. I did struggle. And ironically, every job I've ever applied for where I've had an interview, I've always been hired. Some jobs I've actually walked in and there were no openings, and I've said, I need a job. And they said, you're hired. And this one instance, this person did not hire me right away. And I was like, what's going on here? Wait a minute. Do you know what you're getting here? And they didn't hire me. So then the next year, and I kept pursuing it, there was another opening in the district that I found out word of mouth. It wasn't advertised. They never called me back and said, hey, are you still looking for a job? What's going on? So I was teaching at UB, and then I got a call from two other schools. I got a 300 out of 300 on the New York State test. So they go by ranking, and then the Buffalo City Schools, Cheryl Jackson came in first, so she got the first choice. Someone else came in second, and I came in third. Her first choice, she wound up going to teaching at Kensington High School. I think she said her first day some kid whipped an eraser at her head. And then the next person, I don't know where they went, and then I was the next one. And so I was asked to go teach at two schools in Buffalo, to travel between two schools. And by that time, I had been hired. And, you know, when it rains, it pours. And then I got hired. I walked in and during an interview that you were supposed to apply for beforehand for West Seneca. And I said, I didn't have an application. I don't have anything, but I'm here. And they said, come right up in front of the line. Principal interviewed me and said, I want to hire you. So that's why I was still in shock that this other district hadn't hired me. I'm like, what's going on here? Well, I think something with connections. Somebody else, they're probably a friend of a friend. Right. They came first, so, you know.
What would you say that you bring to these experiences that helps people to see your skill set so clearly? I mean, we're in a time now where it is another situation of a dearth of jobs, you know,
yeah.
Especially in the arts. And to have that sort of confidence, it sounds pretty rare.
Yeah.
But it's not just confidence, it's also experience.
Experience is really number one. To get as much experience on the ground level, and you got to be persistent, and people don't come looking for you. Nobody comes looking for you. Nobody needs a headhunter anymore. I mean, there are headhunters for like big corporations and stuff, but not for the arts. And I mean, and they're cutting arts and music out of a lot of schools, and it's shooting yourselves in the foot. They're not helping people. They're not helping our culture, and I'm worried about our culture. I'm worried about African-American culture. I'm worried about the immigrants. I'm worried about them maintaining their traditions, falling into this trap of things and, you know, comparing corporate logos and identifying themselves through a corporate logo. And, you know, capitalists love that. Let's push that as much as we possibly can, because kids are their big customers. So, and they identify with things that are not real. And the media doesn't mirror the culture. The culture mirrors the media. So they're trying to act like what they see. They don't understand that they're actually being used.
Mm-hmm.
And they can't separate the fact that, say, you have a figure like Beyonce. You know, this beautiful woman, beautiful voice. Well, first of all, you can't just, by dressing like her, become her. She works her butt off. And she's been working her butt off since she was like 15. You know, and she came up with the hard way. It doesn't just fall in your lap. You have to be realistic. So I think that our society is that of entitlement. And it's like, you know what? It's the law of physics. You can't get something for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
You have to, you know, even people who are born into money can be miserable. The other thing I would highly recommend, and this is what any successes that I've had have come from connections. Like I said, nobody knows you're there. You have to make yourself known. So, you know, I've never had a dealer come into my studio and say, oh, knock on the door and go, oh, I hear you have some interesting paintings. Can I come in and look at them? No, I would get, oh, so-and-so has recommended me to look at your work, but they don't come after you. You still have to go after them. You say, they would introduce you to an art dealer or curator. Make yourself known. I think the biggest criticism I've gotten from, well, for a dealer, was that I didn't have enough work. I said, you know, the problem with selling is that we have to show that you produce. And I thought, well, okay, I don't know, how many paintings did Mark Rothko make? Not that I would ever compare myself to Mark Rothko, but, you know. And then I've had other, and then other artists. You talk to other artists, people who are in really into it. And I've heard from female artists. I have my best friend is an artist, and she's pretty successful. I don't know how you measure success, but I mean, she shows a lot, and she sells, you know, and her work goes for good money. And she's recognized, and she's had reviews and art forum and stuff like that. And I remember I worked for Michael Opping at the Albright Knox Art Gallery. He's in Dallas now, Fort Worth. And he said to me, he says, you'll never know if you're a good artist in a way. He says, only history will tell. Because you could look at, you know, like, let's say Jackson Pollock, who nobody took seriously. You know, a few people. And then you have the PR that are saying, is he trying to pull a joke on us? And then you have somebody who needs to write about it and say what he's actually doing. But you need that history in order to decide. But good old grit is the thing that works. And I think with anything. But I think it's even harder for artists because I think Americans look, and maybe not just Americans, but they look at art as something that's something you don't really need. And they're very opinionated about it. They're not open-minded. And so you have to be true to yourself and develop your skill. You can have a great idea, but if you don't have a skill, it's going to look bad. And no matter how brilliant it is. I have work in the physics building, Fronczak Hall at UB, with Gary Nickard and Reinhard Reitzenstein. We just kind of work well together because we're into science, but we're not good enough at science so that we would rather do a simulacrum of science. We're more into the aesthetic of science. So I did a series of paintings. They commissioned us to do some work for permanent installation. I did a series of paintings that have physics formula written on them. And I did that a long time ago. I think I did it because I just liked the aesthetic of how the lettering looks. So what I would do is I would take, in the old days, I would take, and I think actually you guys have the one painting. These deer heads are clashing, and the formula for that is about two bodies in cosmology, I almost said cosmetology. In cosmology, two bodies that are drawn together by gravity, and so I put that on there. And then I had another one that actually I sold to a museum in Memphis, I think it is. And I'm not sure, but I think Flying Fish Records bought it because it's a painting of flying fish, but it has the formula on it. And here's an example of bias in the art world with women. And I've had this happen a couple of times, and I've actually had people act shocked. And that is that one painting, the deer heads used to hang in our apartment in Brooklyn. We had a huge, huge ceiling, huge walls. And it sat next to a Barbara S. photograph. And people would come in, and it was mostly men. Curators, or who were friends. And one of the things that I found with some people was that you're not allowed to be more than one thing. If you're a good cook, you can't be a good artist too. If you are, not everybody, but, and I don't know where that mentality comes from, because I also have people who think that it's great that somebody can do more than one thing well. But unfortunately, I didn't have enough confidence, and I let them get to me. And they would come in and say, I had this happen to me with a different painting in a show, say, who did that painting? And I'd say, I did. And all of a sudden I get, oh, why? Because women can't do a big aggressive type thing and paint with ferocity. And that happened a couple times. I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe this. Because I've always been told I can do anything. I'm equal. No. I mean, unfortunately. And I think that that's why some women give up and just say, you know, I'll just stay by the wayside. And then if a woman is assertive, they're called different names. Whereas man pushes himself, you have to be assertive. You don't have to be aggressive. But if a woman does that, she's considered aggressive. That's like, oh, she's so nasty. She's a real bitch. You know, and she's got a major ego. No, it's a two-edged sword there. So you have to be careful and not be discouraged. Because I've had people tell me, friends, and I've been around thousands of artists. I've applied for 200 grants, not me personally, but they'll say they've applied for 200 grants, but they don't give up, and then they got that one grant. So you keep working at it and working at it. You can't give up. And then later on, as you get older, you start realizing what the priorities are, and you might want to talk to an older artist and say, well, what would you go back and do differently? And they might say something like, well, first of all, make yourself a schedule. My biggest problem is time. My personal problem is time. I don't have time. Because when I make art, and I'm sure many other artists do this, is that I can't just go in, spend a half an hour, and then leave. I have to go in and get into the zone, because it's for me. It's like meditating, or it's fun, it's enjoyable. It's also painful, but there's nothing like it. That one painting that I did, the flying fish one, I think it was, one of them, I remember. I painted that in the vault over where Hallows used to be. And I used to have a studio there. And I remember coming out of the studio panting like a beagle had just chased rabbits through a field. And I thought, there's no feeling like this. This is better than drugs. And anybody who does drugs is crazy. You should pick up a guitar, cook, run, something else, because there's nothing like that adrenaline. And then you know it's good. You know it works. And sometimes you work on it, and it's because you didn't put yourself into it. Or maybe you don't have the skill that you're trying to do, so you need to go figure that skill out. Or pay somebody to do it for you. You know, I don't do my own. I used to stretch my own canvases. Nobody could do them as well, and I couldn't afford, you know, for someone else to do it. But now they make them really good gallery stuff. And it doesn't matter anymore. I used to be into mixing the rabbit hide glue and putting it on the canvas. I loved the whole process. And then I thought, well, you know what? I'm just delaying. I'm getting into the craft. I think it's good to do that, like when you're in school, so you know what the process is. And you should do that. Just like cooking. You should know how, don't just open up a bag and pour it out. You should know the process of how it got there. And you appreciate it more. And that's the fun part. Like, actually, my moon pictures, the first moon picture that I did, and the reason why I got into the moon, well, we were into astronomy. We had a telescope, and we'd go out on the porch and look at stuff, and my brother and I would, like, try to find planets, and we were into weather, mm-hmm. into nature, and when I think about it, my students are not very curious. I'm like, do you know, I'm giving you information that took me 50 years to get, and you're getting it for free now? I was like, well, I don't know, maybe I would have been like that when I was their age. More likely not, but I think that's something that's learned, that's taught, that knowing stuff is fun, you know?
Well, you also have to be in an educational system that reinforces that mm-hmm. learning is not work, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, a lot of these kids are growing up at a time where, you know, they're never taught to love to read, because reading is always a chore.
Exactly.
You know, so it's, in some ways it's them, in some ways it's the systems they're in.
That's true. Well, and I tell kids, you know, with math, I struggled with math in the beginning, and then all of a sudden I got it because I had some people help me, like my brother, some other people, my mother, and it's like, I missed a step. And once you miss a step, because it's not intuitive,
right.
You have to go back. So once you go back and get help, but I tell them, math, I love math now, because it's like a puzzle, and you're figuring something out, and this is a challenge. And if you look at people from other cultures, they don't get into the math like we get into it. They go for the basic stuff, fractions, most important things. And I watched a program where it was a Japanese classroom. And their textbook is about a quarter of an inch thin. Our textbooks are like, you know, 5 inches thick. And what the teacher did was, and they showed what the difference between our cultures was, that the teacher would put the answer on the board, and then you had to come up with the problem. And I thought that was brilliant. And they said, that's how they learn. And they're competitive in that, but they win with accolades. You know, it's all intrinsic. But I think we get hit over the head because of our curriculum that's pushed on us. These teachers don't want to have to teach this stuff. Same thing with reading. I see kids who love to read when it's something that they can relate to. And one of the problems with reading in schools, too, when they're little, is the teachers read to them. They need to have the kids do the reading. And I think kids actually enjoy reading mm-hmm. when they're little, because it's all fun, it's great stuff, mm-hmm. but something happens, and I think you're right, it becomes a chore, because now it's about testing, mm-hmm. and now they're worried that, you know, it's like, who cares? I know the most successful people on the planet who didn't do well in school.
But that's not really offered up as a perspective, you know? The same way from the institution.
I know. Well, you know, Sir Ken Robinson, have you ever listened to any
no.
of this? You should listen to him on TED, or he's an educator, philosopher kind of guy, English guy. He's brilliant, absolutely brilliant, and he's funny. He was talking about how there, you know, the different intelligences, And we're all meant for different things. You know, there's no way I'm going to be a pharmacist. I can't think of anything more boring, but you might think that that is brilliantly fun and wonderful that you can help people because you're built differently. And he said that there was this girl in England who the counselor, the mother asked if he would come and talk to the teachers and the counselors about how they can get her to do better in school because they were friends. And he said, sure, you know, I'll come and see what we can do. So they were all there and they're talking, and then the counselor and the mother, and he went out. He said, we're going to go out here for a minute. We're just going to have a little chat. And he said that there was music playing in the room. They had left the girl in, and he said that he happened to look through the window from the door and saw her dancing. And he said, ah, she's a dancer. Enroll her in dance classes immediately. And the mother did. And now she is, I forgot her name, but she's a famous choreographer. She did Cats mm-hmm. in London.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, that's what it's about. It's like, you know, I have kids who are just, they just want to work on cars. They love that. They love the mechanical stuff. They don't want to know necessarily what the capital of Burma is.
Mm-hmm.
Although it's a good idea to know those things. I just meant that hypothetically. But I just heard somebody talking from the business point of view on the radio. He said that it's fine to go to Harvard for philosophy. You're probably going to do okay anyway because you wouldn't have gotten into Harvard if you didn't have some kind of money or skills or whatever. But actually, you're better off going to a much more inexpensive school, community school, and learning a skill. There's a huge drought as far as, or dearth of people who know how to do things like tile, lay tile, make bricks, make jewelry. A lot of this stuff is outsourced. That's the other thing. And I'll tell you something funny. The older I get, Winston Churchill said, a young man who isn't a liberal has no heart. He said, an old man who isn't a conservative has no brain. And I thought, in a way, he's kind of right. But I think what happens is that you become more aware of what's going on and how we're being screwed. And into thinking, we think we got a nice big piece of the cake. We don't even have a corner of the cake. My father has this theory that the people who are in charge of the world live out on a yacht in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, and they're the ones that are running everything. And I talked to Gary about this, and I thought, well, you know, capitalism should be a good thing, but it isn't. It's not working because it doesn't treat people fairly. It's like, I'm more equal than you are. And there's this privilege and keeping the people down. And then when I saw, and this is actually not that new, that percentage of the one percenters, I remember learning about that a long time ago. And people getting away with paying for politicians, either side, anybody. I mean, when I think about the BP oil spill, whatever happened to that? Why aren't they talking about that? They donated
the spill in Virginia.
They gave $800,000 to Obama and to the other party too to hedge their bets. But that's, you don't take money from a foreign government. It's a foreign government. How did they get away with that?
So I want to talk a little bit about your work. You know, you work in a number of different mediums.
Mm-hmm.
You're both a painter and a photographer
mm-hmm.
and a filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
How do you identify with all these different mediums that you work in?
Well, it's hard because I think it's kind of like I want to be able to do a lot of things so that if I have an idea, I think, oh no, this needs a sound. I might do an animation or like take film footage from, let's say, some nature. I did a lot of nature stuff
mm-hmm.
and I would take it and add like different, like a strange kind of music to it. Like I had kangaroos hopping. Actually, this was in Tony Conrad's class. I took film footage of kangaroos hopping and put it to like the German marching music. And then I had the Germans marching and I had it to the skippy kangaroo stuff. Well, that was as a student. But now I like sound. I play guitar. I really like music. And I play guitar and I like sound and sound effects. I always thought it would be cool to be a Foley person. You know, the people that make all the sound effects and put coconuts together and stuff like that. I want to be everything. There's just no way you can do that, though. I don't think that an artist should have to be just a painter or just a photographer. I think you're an artist, and you use whatever medium you want. And I think that that's becoming more how everything's evolving, because I remember a long time ago talking to some German artists, and they said, you can't do that. You have to be just a painter or just a photographer. You can't be both. And I thought, well, that's baloney. You're an artist. It's like I'm a chef. You can't tell me I can only cook Chinese food. I can cook French or cook whatever I want, Japanese. And so I think that in some way, the art world is fascist. You know, they're just like so controlling, and it's like you have to do it this way or it's no way. And I'm like, there's no rules. I mean, the rule is that it should have an idea, and that's it. It should have some kind of an idea, and whatever, if it's successful or not, whatever, that's another story. But I think art is about play and curiosity, finding out what's making the bushes shake. You know, you turn around and it stops, and it's like, wait a minute, I want to find out what's in there. And I got really into bird watching, because I don't know how these things happen. I think it's just like I said, I think when you're encouraged when you're little to look. My first adventure as a thief was when I used to watch my grandmother dig up bulbs and replant them and work in a garden. And so I thought, oh, that's something I want to do. So I would go to our neighbors and I'd dig up their bulbs and I'd bring them home and I'd plant them in our garden. And we lived upstairs from my aunt, and my aunt would say, where are all these flowers coming from? And I didn't realize that you're not supposed to steal people's bulbs. So, but I just wanted to do that because I think I like to see change. You have control over something. You know, I'm making a plant grow, or planting a seed and then watching it grow is fascinating. So I think the digging in the soil. If you watch a kid, for example, in my art classes, I teach them how to draw, and I try to get them to get the technique down, and they keep saying, I can't draw. And I say, if you can put a pencil down on the paper and drag it across the paper, you're drawing. You know, it's how to train yourself to look at it. Nobody's born knowing how to do it. It's like a language. And this is just the skill. Later on, you can change it. You can do whatever you want, because it's a form of communication. It's like writing. Okay, where you put the words and how you put the words is going to make a difference in what kind of information you want people to get. Same thing with music. And then I thought, you know, problem with art, visual art, maybe because of the internet now, it's a lot more accessible. It's not accessible. You can't see it. You have to go to see the Mona Lisa, the actual Mona Lisa, you have to be in the Louvre. If you want to hear Miles Davis, you don't have to go to the Blue Note. You can just put that CD on and listen to Miles Davis. You're not going to experience him in person anymore. Of course, it's not around anymore. But that reaches the entire planet. My art is not going to reach the entire planet. So then I started thinking, what is something everybody sees? Everybody sees the moon, the stars, the clouds. Everybody sees animals. Okay, so one day I said, maybe the moon. I want everybody to see. I want to paint the moon. And I think because I wanted to do something tedious to develop my skill as a painter and prove that I can do it so that I don't have to do it anymore. Now I can just start throwing paint around, but thoughtfully, you know, like even Jackson Pollock, when he was dripping his paint, he was conscious about where he was dripping his paint, because you could make a mess and it could look like mud, but his were beautiful, like mind designs. And then you know that to do that feels so good. So my kids, when they see something like that, they're like, I want to do that. And when we go outside and we do it, I mean, they're in heaven, because there's no judgment. You know, there's no, it's just action. And it's like dancing. I heard the other day was the reason why people like music so much is because it makes you move, and humans want to move. They love the act of dancing, moving around. So anyway, I went on Gary's computer screen. He has this big monitor. And there is a telescope that you can access through NASA. So you can look at the moon, not live, but kind of live. And so I clicked on the site, and there's nothing there. And I go, oh, it's all black. So I'm scrolling, and all of a sudden it starts coming in. And it's huge. And the detail, the resolution is so amazing. it scared the crap out of me. I was like, oh my God. It's like standing right outside the moon. And I was like, this is unbelievable. This is like the sublime. This is in a vacuum. This is us. We're out in space. We're in the, you know, people are talking, arguing over stuff, and it's like, there are supernovas that are exploding in the universe. What are you fretting about? You know? And I'm looking at this thing, I go, oh my God. I think it's kind of like eating it. Now I need to eat it. So I'm going to paint it. It's kind of like a fear of nature, a fear of the unknown, of the sublime and death. So I took some pictures from the telescope. You can do this cool thing where you can go over the planet, you can go over the moon, and it'll show you different vectors. You can look at it from above, from the side, you can go into craters. So I decided to isolate one, and I thought, okay, this is going to be a good exercise of pure insanity. And what I decided to do, I used to, sometimes I would project and trace, mm-hmm. just to get a basic placement. It worked out because then I don't consider it cheating. I just consider it, I'll pretend I'm Vermeer. I'm using a camera obscura. So anyway, I just wanted to get the basic placement because I'm not used to this yet. And then I said, okay, now I'm going to start painting without doing that because I don't like the look of the projected. I don't want it to be too perfect. So I started doing that, and that forces you to look even harder at what you're painting. So I started doing that with birds' nests. Now all my neighbors are bringing me birds' nests, and I'm drawing these nests, and I'm going in and out into all these little tangles. And I think, in a way, it's kind of like knitting. And that you can do, but you can't watch TV at the same time. I used to edit film and watch TV at the same time. But you can't do that. You can listen to stuff. You can listen to music. Some of my paintings have a name. Like that first moon painting is David Sedaris. Uh-huh. Because I was listening to David Sedaris when it was his first book, and I laughed so hard. You can't listen to David Sedaris at the gym because you'll be running on the treadmill and all of a sudden you burst out laughing and people look at you like you're crazy. And I wanted to get good at painting so I can say I can paint and practice. Now, you know, we kind of learned how to paint in college. I think we learned more how to draw. And I had some good Drumlin, that she was a good drawing teacher. Harvey Breverman, excellent drawing teacher. He said I was his best and worst student at the same time, because whenever I worked, it was the best work, but I was too lazy. And I thought, oh, that's true. It's because, you know, it's like giving up, you know, if you don't know what you're doing. So that's why developing skills is really helpful. Because even if you don't have a good idea, you can sit down and just practice drawing a leaf or something like that. Look at a how-to book or look on YouTube. See how to draw something, and it's like, wow, look how much farther I've gotten just from doing that. When I play guitar, I do that. I'll look up a song and I'll look up how somebody plays it, and everybody plays it a different way, which drives me crazy, so I just give up and I just figure it out my own way. So I think textures, you know, in teaching you get better, hopefully, at what you do, and working with textures, now things that you can touch, but also going back to the moon, I was thinking this, okay, sun, everybody sees the moon, but now everybody's going to see this painting, and it's a darn good painting, even to this day. Like, when I think about, you know, when you look at something that historical, you go back and you still say it still works. I did a painting once. I was getting into just putting, like, rough surfaces down and then painting on top of them, and I was doing these kind of weird, creepy animals, and I did this animal. It was like a prehistoric marsupial. And that I got a lot of books, a lot of animal books. And I kind of like the idea of cartoons. Mm-hmm. And I do like some pop surrealism stuff. Those guys are really good. I mean, they're really skilled. You have to be really skilled to draw like that. And they practice all the time. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of not my thing. It's a little too cartoony. So I did this painting of this creature. And he's looking at fireflies. And I just made it up. And I think I got that from, like, you know, looking at illustrations. And this oil painting and wax and stuff. And I'm looking at, he's looking at fireflies, and he's going like this, with his eyes open, fascinated, like, he sees these fireflies, and the glow from the fireflies is lighting his face up. And to this day, it's in our house, to this day it makes me laugh. Oh, I had it in a show, Actually, it was in the Albright Knox. Some woman called and asked me how much how much I wanted for it. And I think I said $1,000 or something like that, which is not very much. It was about this big. I said, I'll take $1,000. And she says, what? That's way too much money. I just got... I'm like, oh my God. I was like, okay, $800. That's too much money. What do you think it should be worth? You know how long it took me to paint this painting? So I said, well, you know, think about it. I'm not going to go any lower than that. And I thought, it's not meant to be. As a matter of fact, the painting that I... Flying Fish painting I was telling you about, when it was sold, I was actually kind of disappointed. I thought, oh, I'm never going to see it again. Well, I have a transparency of it, but it's not the same thing. It's like 7 feet by 3 feet. And, and I thought, it made me so happy to look at. And that's how I felt about this other painting, is that to this day, when I look at it, you just laugh. I did another painting like that, a smaller one. I went with my friend to a, I forgot the name of the place, some fancy art supply place in Brooklyn that builds frames and canvases. And they had this beautiful square canvas with linen on it for $50, on sale for $50. And back then, that was a lot of money for me. So I said, ah, heck, I'm going to buy it. And I decided that I was going to, I put another kind of weird prehistoric creature on there. It's like, they're all furry and they have buck teeth and, you know. And this one, he's looking at bees. He's looking at a beehive and the bees are flying around his head and he's got this goofy look on his face like, oh, cool, bees. And that makes me laugh. Probably my biggest inspiration, I think it starts when you're little, is from the cartoons that we used to watch. Mm-hmm. And they were like those 20s cartoons with like jazz music and Jack Teagarden type of, you know, muted horn. And I just love that, the way that stuff looked. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't like the, I didn't like when that kind of canned looking, not very well drawn stuff like the Flintstones. It wasn't, I could tell the difference between the styles. So then I decided, yeah, I want to continue to do these. I'm really getting into charcoal. Not just now, I mean, I started like 3 years ago. Charcoal, drawing, paper. Love paper. Really nice drawing paper. I think I just love the materials. Mm-hmm. And I like starting with a nice base. And then now I'm like, oh, this little bone would look good on here. It's almost like making a drapeau in a way, like a magic drapeau. I'm going to start adding like all of these magic elements, feathers. And I even have, I bought some cheese that's wrapped in chestnut leaves from France. When I unwrapped it, I saw these leaves and I went, oh, these would look great on a painting. I was stuck on a piece of paper. So I had these leaves, the first set of leaves my dog ate because they still had cheese on it. So the other set I have in the refrigerator to keep them from drying out. And I'm going to be using those, putting those down. So I think that came from Picasso. Seeing him, and I don't know if it was the movie or a photograph, because I'm absolutely in love with Picasso. His boldness, his sexuality, his, you know, absurdness, but he's so smart. And that he took a fish bone, he had eaten a fish, and like a flounder or sole, the bone structure stays intact, so you can just pull it right up and the meat will stay behind. The fish bones, and then I think he dipped them in ink or something like that, and then laid them down on a piece of paper and made a print with it. And I thought, that is play. That is so much fun. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Where do I sign up? Where do I get a job like that? You know, I want to be able to win the lottery, so that's all I can do is just play with this stuff. But that's how things are discovered. I mean, that's what, you know, in the cave, somebody probably touched some charcoal from having, like, a fire, and it gets on your hand, and then you touch a wall, and you say, oh, look what happened. And I also like the challenge of not having fancy stuff. You can have it, but it's there if you need it. But I would rather... You know, Pat Bazelon, I used to drive her crazy because she would have the fanciest and most expensive equipment, like tripods and light stands and clamps, and I'd say, I'm going to use that branch over there, and I'm going to put a piece of cardboard from over there, and I'm going to tape it on with masking tape, and it would look ridiculous, but it worked. I was like, I'd rather improvise, because I need the challenge, or else I'm bored. I think that's that's why artists make art, because you're going to be bored. You know what kids say to me? They come in the next day to school, and they will come over to me with their sketchbooks, and they'll say, look what I did last night. I was so bored. And they open it up, and it's like an amazing picture. And I'm like, see? That's what they need to do instead of relying on a video game or whatever. I mean, even video games, in a way, they're kind of like porn. It's like stop already. It's a little bit relief, you know, it's a little challenge. And in some video games, apps, you can learn a lot. I learned a lot from Angry Birds, and I'll tell you how. Angry Birds teaches you not to keep doing the same thing over and over again. Try something different. It's not going to work if you have this thing in your head where you think, if I do it again, it's going to work this time. You know, like a sniglet, I call it like lotto stare. Mm-hmm. Like you scratch off your numbers and the numbers aren't there, but if you stare at it long enough, maybe the numbers will change. No, it's not going to change. So give up. Try something different. Try something radically different. And every time I've tried something radically different, success.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything else you'd like to say about your art and why you create what you create?
Like I said, I like to play with things. Mm-hmm. And I do a lot of thinking. A lot of thinking. And then even more thinking. And then I stare out the window and I look at the sky. Sometimes I'll do a storyboard. When I do photography, I usually I'll draw mm-hmm. stuff before I set up a scene. I have a set of pinhole pictures I'll show you that from different residencies that I'll plan out how I want. My work is cinematographic, really, if you think about it. You know Gregory Crutzen?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. When he first came out, I was really jealous. I was so jealous of him because I thought, oh my God, he's figured it out. He's got this great stuff. And then I decided, it's not really me. You know, it's him. And then he does these big film still type pictures. And I'm thinking, no, you know what? I'm over that. Let him have that. I'm more now into spirituality. I just want to be, I know I'm going to wind up back in the ground. So I'm just preparing myself. and looking like, to me, art is a portal. It takes you into another place of ideas and thought. And otherwise, it's just an illustration. And illustrations are fine, but they have a different place. You know, it's very conservative. Like, even when I used to draw in school, I used to draw small. And my teachers would say, get a big pad, draw big, be more expressive, big lines. But I was, like, too tight because I was worried about, I wanted things to be realistic looking. Gary and Reiner got me involved. Gary helped me a lot. He got me involved with UB and doing the commission for the physics department. And I was a good fit because my work was already about science. And I had done physics formulas. So what they did was they just told me what formulas they wanted. And the paintings themselves are skies from other paintings like Constable. Or I just kind of either stole a little section out and painted it. Or borrowed a little bit from here and there, but I wanted to look kind of atmospheric. And whenever I saw an opportunity looking for work, and I said, oh, they're looking for birds' nests, or they're looking for artists who work with mixed mediums in an abstract way. Oh, okay, I'll send some pictures, or people over to the studio, or ask people for their advice. And then they can direct you. They might say, I just happen to know that there's a show in California right now. Or juried show, that's a good thing to get into also, because the people who jury the show are usually curators from another gallery or museum, and they'll see your work and they'll go, this person's interesting. I should watch for them. Now I recommend you definitely have to have a web page. I have a web page, but it has nothing on it. So I'm going to be putting. That's why that file is small, because that was going to be the stuff I was going to put on the web page. So you should have a web page. And now with the way the internet works, you could have links, you could have people go to your stuff, and now you could sell work online. I actually bought work online. It's time. This job is a soul sucker. And you know, by the time you get home, I mean, you're dealing with 123 14-year-old kids, teenagers a day. Most of them act like 14-year-olds. And then this new APPR stuff that they put on us, kind of tough, and I don't want to make excuses. I don't want that to be my excuse. And I think it's because, to me, making art is the most important thing anybody can do. You have to make art some way, whether you're a writer, or you have to connect something. I mean, if you look at other cultures, like Japan, they worship their creative people. Go to Mexico, I wouldn't have to pay taxes if I lived in Mexico, because artists don't pay taxes. Artists don't pay taxes in Ireland. Artists and writers. The trade-off is you have to donate something. You make work and donate or whatever. And I thought, well, that's really important. And then you maintain traditions. But I just feel that even my female friends, if I think about how they're kind of marginalized as artists, they're around the big guys who smoke cigars and hang out with Larry Gagosian. And you gotta find a way around that. Going through the back door, make friends with the wife. You know, it's sexist, but it's, we don't have that much time. So I think that about promoting yourself, inviting people over, for example, like from the university. People are in town. Go see the galleries that are here. They say to make yourself a big fish in a small pond first before you try to hit the cities. Now, I even know lots of galleries who are moving out to California because they can't afford to be in New York anymore. And California is where they're buying art. So that tells you something. The other thing is that you're competing with the graduates from Yale who have, like, you pay all that tuition to go to Yale so that you can be assured that you're going to have your thesis show is going to be at, like, Matthew Marks Gallery or something like that. And then you're in, like, Flint. So the school that you go to makes a big difference. Being a trust fund kid helps, too. But I think it comes down to the product. It is a product. It's like, what are you presenting? How do you want to get, what do you want? When I was little, and I used to be in art school, and people would ask me, what kind of artist do you want to be? And I used to think, well, it would be fun to be an illustrator, you know, to draw birds. Mm-hmm. And I actually went to college with somebody whose father was a bird illustrator for Encyclopedia Britannica. And I thought, how exciting, you get to travel all over the world and take pictures of the birds and then draw them like Audubon, you know, and do all this stuff. And the stories he would tell, you know, about going to Costa Rica and the kind of birds you see and the people that you meet, Indians and the natives. And boy, that would be exciting. Or working for National Geographic, but it's so hard. And you've got to be, watch out for bugs. And actually, one time we went to Northern Ireland in 1989 for the anniversary of Bloody Sunday. And we were all kinds of journalists there because they had festivals and music and protests, and we went with the Irish People newspaper, and we were with real photojournalists, the tags that they could get into anywhere. And this one guy was a friend of Gary's, Bill Biggert. He later on wound up getting killed at the World Trade Center. He ran in with the firemen to get images, and the building came down on him. So interestingly, his camera survived. He had a film camera and a digital camera. And both of them, there were still images on there. And they found him about, I don't know, some days later, but he wasn't evaporated like a lot of other people. And that's sad. You know, you never expect to get killed in your own city. But Palestine had been shot at by Israeli soldiers, Palestinians, and all kinds of stuff. So anyway, we're in Northern Ireland. And I thought, boy, this is exciting, because there's like, you're not supposed to take pictures. And there's the British soldiers, mm-hmm. and then the Ulster soldiers. And we went to this one protest where these kids were tearing off tarmac off of the street, and they were throwing it at the soldiers. They were in these tanks, or these things they called, I want to say pigs. They're kind of an armored car, and they shoot plastic bullets at the people back. And I thought, this is really exciting. I was not scared. I kept taking pictures, and I had my camera out of a chip shop, and I'm taking pictures. And these little boys came up to me and said, hey, you want to get some good pictures? And I said, sure. And they go, come with us. So I started running with them, and there's hundreds of people running. The tanks are coming down the street shooting. And one of the kids I was with got shot in the leg, and they dragged him off. And I just kept running, and I said, oh, my God, now what? Felt fun and exciting. And I'm running and running and running, and I don't know how I got over a fence, but I got over a fence, and I could hear Gary and these other people going, where's Patty? Where's Patty? Where's Patty? And I was already on the other side of the fence before they got there. And I said, I don't know how I got here, but I'm here. I'm okay. I could do this forever. I love it. So you can see how these journalists become addicted to the rush of that. Anyway, So the pictures from something like that, an experience, you send them out. You send them to places with a little story, and this is what I was told. I did some work for Town & Country magazine, and they said, bring in your work. Let's see your slides. And then you start getting little jobs from something like that. Look at Nancy J. Parisi. She started off doing little jobs, and now she's doing really great stuff, big stuff. And so you start out small, take whatever you can get. The other thing that I was taught is never pass up an opportunity to show. Even if it's in a bathroom, show your work. Make that the most incredible bathroom you ever could possibly imagine. Never pass up an opportunity. And once I get this new body of work together, I'm going to start cashing in my chips. So I'm going to contact the galleries I used to work with, because there was a big hiatus when I started teaching. So I did things. I did show with Gary and Reiner, and we also had a show in Montreal, the bird's nests and the moon, and work with other people. But like I said, take whatever comes your way. Well, you know, I don't know, an old folks home, I don't know if that's worth the effort. Unless you can get people to come there and look at the work. Otherwise, there's going to be oatmeal all over your paintings, you know. Flaky oatmeal. I don't like that painting. So, when I was in high school, I auditioned for a musical at our school, and I didn't get anything. They did offer me to be a voice off stage, and I thought, no, I don't want to be off stage. And I went home and told my mother. She said, so did you get the role? And I said, no. I said, but they offered me this thing to sing off stage. And she said, because I had this real, they wanted a real flourishy kind of voice. And I said, I told her about it. And she says, and you didn't take it? She says, don't you ever do that again. She says, you take that role and you blow them out of their seats with that voice. And I thought, she's right. Because when I was in sixth grade, and I was in Buffalo Theater Workshop before that, when I was in sixth grade, I was in another little play. And I had like maybe five lines. And after the play, people were coming up to me going, you were amazing! You were fantastic! And that's why, you know, when you see these actors in movies, like they're in it for like 2-3 minutes, but they blow everybody else out of the water. That's your craft. You need to like suck it up. And so I'll never do that again. And I think about even like, artists have talked to me. Doug and Mike Starn actually told me. I showed at a gallery that they showed at in Soho. Mm-hmm. And it was a pay-to-play gallery, mm-hmm, where, you know, you join it. And they told me, and I was working for them at the time, and we're also friends, and they were really, really nice guys. They always gave me good advice, and anytime you need anything. That was their first show in New York, was at the same gallery. And they said, never pass up an opportunity, even if you have to pay for it. Just the whole point is to get people out to look at it. So I think that's the problem, is to get people to, you got to get people to see your work somehow. Now with the internet, it's so much easier. Phenomenal. You know, if we had that back then, that would have been really helpful. Put the word out. You know Rich Tomasello?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, he's a colleague. Mm-hmm. He works at Lafayette now. I've known him for a long time. He actually went to the high school that I teach. His teacher was one of my colleagues. Mm-hmm. And he's got the right attitude. And you could grow and you get better and better and better and better. And one of the things is like, if you make a body of work and then you don't show it or you stop, you have to take it seriously. Like, it's a job. It's your life. It's your career. I don't consider teaching my career. I'm an artist first. Teaching is for health insurance. Mm-hmm. And I'll do the absolute best I can. I mean, maybe I could do a little bit better, but I don't have it in me. You know, I try. You know, I mean, there's so many things. It's too bureaucratic. Mm-hmm. I'm just not a bureaucrat. I hate all the paperwork. I think with art, too, is that you can connect anything through art.
Mm-hmm.
Anything. Music, literature, math. Everything. Your design, and I start out the first day of class, I say, everything you have is because somebody designed it. Somebody created that with a certain aesthetic, depending on where you live and what your culture is. Mm-hmm. All of that is, and it's all learned. But something is a symbol for something. Look at Doc Martin shoes or boots, and you see if it's paired with something, it means one thing. If it's, mm-hmm, paired with something else, it's a signifier. And if you can master that and start figuring, be observant. I think one of the problems is that parents discourage kids from going into art because they, mm-hmm, think you're not going to make any money. I think now you have a lot better chance of making money in art because of design. That they don't outsource. Where they make it, maybe. But you still need designers. I have a lot of students who are designers, and they love it. They design everything from like really cool furniture. Some of them are graphic designers. Some of them are environmental planners for cities. And so you got to know, and you got to get out there. Watch a lot of movies, because they have to accomplish. Each picture is an artwork, each frame. Well, good movies. For some of my earliest paintings, I took pictures off the television screen of like Hercules movies with Steve Reeves, the Italian ones, the real corny ones. And I actually liked the grain on the television screen. I thought that that worked well. But then what I would do is I would paint those. And I painted them in monochrome. And I think because I was just fascinated by, you know, mythology and the campiness and kitsch of like a spaghetti mythology movie. And I was like, oh yeah, that's good. And I like that close-up of a woman's green face with the Medusa snakes. Fancy hairdos, you know. Pop culture. So I think just about everything can be interesting. It's just how you approach it. Now, you got to market yourself. You have to treat yourself like a business. And record everything. Don't go, oh no, I wonder where that photo went. Donate your artwork.
What's your feeling on that, about donating to auctions and that sort of thing?
Well, after a while, it depends. Gary's against it. It depends on how much you can afford to give up. If it's something like a print, a photographic print, or an archival digital print, yeah, but after a while, and I think it depends on the place. You know, like definitely people who helped you, like SIPA and Hall Walls. That I think that when you get really big, not that I'm worried about that, people who are really big, let's say Cindy Sherman, if you start giving to one place, you're going to have to give to so many others. And I think that becomes a burden on the artist. So Doug and Mike Starn, I think SIPA at the time, they asked me to ask Doug and Mike if they would donate a piece. Was to SIPA. So I asked them, and they said, you know what? They never showed us. We would if they had showed us, but they never showed us. I said, they never showed you? Oh my God. Because they used to show everybody, you know, all the newest people. And I thought, well, that's a good lesson. Hall Walls, I was in a show at Hall Walls a million years ago and donated an etching. It wound up in William F. Buckley's house. You know who he is? Yeah. Very conservative. I just thought that was funny. Yeah, probably because I think it was the Triceratops goes with communism. So he probably had a funny take on it.
Are there any other needs that you can articulate that you've experienced throughout your career that the larger community can provide you with?
Venue. Definitely venue. Feedback. Yeah, I think that publicity is always good. And like I said, with the internet now, everybody can see your stuff. I have on ArtNet, there's a couple of places that I look and I go, oh my God, that's my friend. And they sold the original, or they still have the original, but they made prints from that. You can buy for $150. And you think, wow, that's great. But I think that what happened to artists is that they've done a big disservice to art with Sotheby's and Christie's with this overblown pricing of art, like it's $100 million for a living artist. It's like, come on, that's crazy. Where's that coming from?
Capitalism.
Yeah,
it's art
as a product, as a thing. I mean, as a corporate logo. Jeff Koons, I think, is an abomination because he's bought right into that. He used to be the bad boy, now he's just one of them.
What do you think about Shepard Fairey and Obey?
Well, it's interesting. I think he started off with a good thing, but now it's like Banksy.
And now, yeah, and definitely what I think so fascinating about the Obey thing especially is that at a certain point it really became this brand clothing line that now everybody's wearing it without getting the joke.
Oh, yeah, I know.
You know, like everything says Obey.
Right, right.
And even the labels say Obey Propaganda.
Yeah.
But it's worn like it's Nike. Can you still call it a critique if you're making money hand over fist from it?
No. When I went to high school, I went to Narden, the girls were rich, and I wasn't rich. So I couldn't afford the kind of clothes those girls wore. And they were all preppy. And they would wear Papagallo shoes, and they would wear sweaters with monograms on them. And I'm like, that's not me. So you decide to become the X class. And I would start hanging around with girls who were like me. We'd go to Toronto and buy, you know, like, cool skirts or stuff that was like, I don't want to say mod, but more non-preppy, you know, more individualistic. And because preppy is like a uniform. And it means my daddy has lots of money. We have even had a girl who had a driver drop her off at school. And I used to take the city bus. They had a little green pass, and I get on Hurdle and take the city bus. My brother went to Canisius. We take the city bus to down Elmwood, get off the bus, walk to school. I mean, we could survive. We knew how to survive. But there were other kids like that, which was good. And Narden was actually a pretty good school, but they didn't have art. There was no art. Now
that's
they do.
Ridiculous.
Yeah. A lot of private schools did not have art. You had to take that separately somewhere else. Because it's about prep, about getting into college, but it wasn't. And then I transferred to Amherst later on because we moved out to Amherst, and it was right down the street, and I went for driver ed and typing, and I fell in love with it. I said, this is a great school. It's so cool. They had scuba diving. I'm like, I want to take scuba diving. And they had art, and that my art teacher was one of my biggest inspirations. Like I said, they were old-timey, taught you how to draw and write. We used to cut our own mats. You know, even now, I think what teachers are doing is that they're doing everything for the kids. I tell my colleagues, don't cut mats for the kids. How are they going to learn how to do it if you do it for them? But they're in a hurry, and they want to be able to do it and make sure it's done right. But we learned how to measure. We learned how to use math, drawing, how to measure the mat board. I would tell the kids, go ahead and use your phone if you need to use a calculator for that, but you should still know how to do that yourself. Mm-hmm. This is part of the process.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we didn't have those,
yeah.
So we had to do it the other way. I mean, we had slide rules and stuff like that, but
mm-hmm.
I have no idea how to use a slide rule. I know other people do. I know a lot of photographers used to use slide rules. When I first started at the Brooklyn Museum, they showed me how to use a slide rule for when you use a bellows on a camera. It takes longer for the light to travel through the bellows, so you have to measure the distance from the object, or to the front of the lens to the back of the thing, and then figure out your f-stop and your shutter speed and all that stuff. I'm like, ugh, okay. But after a while, you got figured out. Actually, somebody taught me, before there were light meters, if you have two lights shining on something and you want to make sure it's even, you put a card up and you make sure that the shadows are even.
Uh-huh.
So you don't even need a light meter. I was like, oh, that's pretty cool. You need to be able to have some tools in your pocket.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, I hardly use my phone. I use my phone mostly for apps.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even call anybody. Like, once in a while, texts are too much work.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I don't want to text. Just call me, you know. I think it's, you know, it depends on what you're used to, what you grew up with. It's not about the medium. It's about the message. I feel as though I want to just keep experimenting and not be afraid. And you know what? If something doesn't work out, hide it in the closet. Keep working. And then working with found objects has really become, you know, fun for me because I hate waste. Just hate. It's like, I don't want to throw this button away. I want to keep it. Or this could go into a collage. And I tell my students, and anybody else, really, good art is clever. Good art is something that's, you go, you look at it and you go, And sometimes it doesn't work. And sometimes it does. Not all of it's going to work. I don't go aha over every Picasso. I do go aha over every single Mark Rothko. But that's because I get what he's doing. If you don't know what the artist's intention is, I think that can be hard. Gary was in London a couple years ago, and he said he was standing in front of, he was at a Mark Rothko show, and a little boy, this is the difference between Americans and Europeans, a little boy said to his father, what's painting about? And his father said, the imminence of death. Wow, that's amazing. Here, I can't imagine somebody saying. So that's the other thing. It's like being innovative. That's what I think about really good comedians is that they are so good at observing. That's why you laugh, because she's like, I missed that. Wow, they are really sharp.
Mm-hmm.
You just take it for granted, and the way they present it
yeah.
is hysterical. You know, I think one of the other things, too, that I've become very aware of with teaching teenagers is what happens at home and how they are neurotic because they think they should have something that they don't need. And they feel as though they're failures if they don't have it. Or they'll just give up. It's like, if I can't have it, that's going to be who I am. Like people who think that they're going to have children because they're an extension of themselves are doing that child a big disservice. It's the worst thing you can do. And then that child then comes to me, and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, there's no way I can undo this. And not just me, but other teachers. And everything, they think everything is just going to be, everything's done for them. I don't give handouts anymore. You have to write, I write on the board, or I'll write, I'll project it, and then you have to write it down. And I tell them why. I said, even if you lose that sheet, the fact that you wrote it down means that you actually read those words. Otherwise, they all leave their sheets on the tables. And I don't want to enable them. I want them to learn. And I tell them, I said, this is for you. This isn't for my convenience. I said, I've printed out thousands of Xeroxes for people and realized it was a waste of paper. If I print out, it's like two sides. I just don't want to waste anymore. Mm-hmm. I think it's driving me crazy. I was thinking, I love things like, I like animations and short films, and I love telling the kids, you know, everybody's an artist. You have water on the table and you start pushing it around to make it into a pattern or salt. And I like that. I like not being dependent on, oh, I can't do it, I don't have the right tool. That's not true. Figure it out. The only thing is, this year in particular, the kids are extremely wasteful, and it's I got to put an end to it. And things are disappearing, and paintbrushes are getting mucked up and not rinsed out. So I'm putting them away. We have to figure out some other way of painting. And I told them at the beginning of the year that I said, when we run out of brushes, what we do is, we're going to have to go out and we're going to have to collect sticks, and then we're going to have to capture squirrels, and we're not going to hurt the squirrels, but we have to cut off some of their fur from their tail, because actually there is squirrel hair, and you attach the fur to the end of the stick, and you have to wrap it with wire, and they sit there like this. Really? I said, yeah. That's how you do it. I said, you know how to catch a squirrel? Do you know how to catch a squirrel? You climb up a tree and act like a nut. So anyway, I told them that's what we're going to have to do. They're going to have to start making their own brushes. Uh-huh. That's all there is to it.
The last question I tend to ask is, what advice do you have for emerging artists? Another form of that I like to ask sometimes is to say, what advice would you give yourself when you were just graduating from UB with your MA?
Don't be lazy. Don't take things for granted. You got to work hard. Things aren't just going to fall into your lap. Stay away from the party mode. Because you're at that age where you're with your college friends and you're like going out for beer and you'd rather be partying than working. Because being an artist is just as rigorous as anything else, if not more, because you're starting off with a handicap. It's not like, I mean, an artist is so vague. It's not like you're going to be a helicopter pilot. You know what you're going to do. Stick with one medium for a while and decide if you really, if you're going to be serious about being an artist, you got to get a book or something. Start a portfolio. Take your work seriously. Take care of your work also. If you have to work a day job, work a day job. Don't use drugs. Wear suntan lotion. It's good to be around other people to share ideas. And I think that's what I loved about college, is you're around people from all over the world and you learn so much from other people. That's why I tell kids in high school, I said, you know, they think high school is the end all. You know, like, this is it. You're not even knowing these people when you graduate. I said, when you get to college, you're going to be so happy. You're going to be so excited. You know, you're going to be in an environment. But they need to be. They're not preparing the kids well enough. Gary told me that they're having a hell of a time trying to get, these kids aren't, they don't know how to read well. And they're being socially promoted through school. And did I read it? Or did somebody tell me that employers are now not looking at how you did in high school or college. They want your SAT scores, because that's the telling feature of whether or not you have any kind of smarts, because teachers are just faking the grades to get you through. And they're faking the grades because they have to. They're being forced to. They're actually told to change the grades in some instances, or they're out. And it's like, wow, you know, this country's doomed. Keep doing that. You know, teach them right in the beginning, in the first place. You know, when I talk to a lot of college kids, I ask them what they want. You know, we're at the supermarket. I say, well, where do you go to school? Go to UP. What are you studying? Communications. What are you going to do with that? I don't know. Okay, you got to start finding out what's related to that, or else you're just going to be checking out groceries for the rest of your life. Unless you want to do that, which could be fun. If you're a writer and you work at night, whatever, that might be a great thing to do if you can make decent money. So you need to focus, and I think that's the key thing. Make it your priority to focus. And don't worry about boyfriend-girlfriend relationships. And, you know, a lot of people have changed their, you know, changed their path because of somebody else inspired or influenced them, not inspired. And then they break up, and then they're in a place that they don't want to be. So you have to take that into effect, too. I've seen that a lot. And don't smoke too much pot, because I have also seen people, very creative people, who have lost opportunities because they had no motivation. Brilliant, smart, educated, but got in too much into the relaxing mode. And that really does affect you. And you know what? I'm not advocating it or saying nay to it. I'm just saying watch out for that, because I can think of a handful of people that have lost out on opportunities because of that. So be careful about that. And get out of the house as soon as possible and stay out of the house. If you can, move to another city. Like I said, even if it's temporary. Unfortunately, with art, unless you paint like horses and ranches and mountains, you really need to be in a bigger city. Buffalo's okay, but it's not a big commercial arts venue. There's only a couple commercial art galleries here. So it's hard for people to make a living as an artist. A lot of people go into teaching positions because that allows them, especially in university, allows them time to paint and make art. And the things are there. So getting into a university scene might help. I actually went back to school after I graduated with my master's degree to take workshops so I could use the equipment at Media Study. So that's, you know, digital stuff. I was surprised that I actually like digital stuff. I like animation. I did go into it when I was a young person. I was like, you know what, you need to learn everything. You need to learn as much as possible. And then you gotta decide what you want. Keep saying, I don't know what I want. Then you're going to be saying that when you're 90. You're like, I don't know what I want. And all of a sudden, time has gone by and you've wasted all of that. And the other thing is that, I don't know about this generation, but my generation, the women were like, oh, I got to get married. I got to have a baby. I got to do this. It's like, that's a career crusher right there. There are a lot of babies in the world, and lots of babies. And there are babies that can be adopted. Women are at a disadvantage. It's like the guy can have a kid and still have his career. You look at the really big artists, these guys, most of them, their wives are like debutantes or whatever. They need somebody to take care of them. That's kind of like a formula in a way. Mm-hmm. They need somebody to take care of them. It's hard to be in a house. Like I even say to Gary, I say to people, don't marry another artist. There's not enough room for you in one house, unless one's a conceptual artist. Like my basement is packed full of scientific equipment. It's like you can't even get over to the laundry, to the washing machine. And it's like, why did I marry an artist? You know, it's just, should have been a poet. If you're going to marry somebody who works small. Unless you work small. One of you has to compromise. Or get a bigger house. Or like, did you ever hear the George Carlin thing about buying a bigger house? He says, so you buy a house. Then you buy stuff. Then you buy more stuff. Then you need a bigger house. So you can put all that stuff into the bigger house. Then you buy more stuff. Then you buy more stuff. And it's true. And it's like, you know, I like minimal. Minimal, minimal. For example, if I run out of socks, I just go out and buy more socks. I took one of those tests, how lazy are you? I got lazy-ish. Because one of the questions was, if you run out of underwear, do you go out and buy more underwear? And I said, yes, I do.
Sometimes that's just the way to do it.
I just can't. I don't have time to do the laundry. It's faster to go buy it. Oh, and travel. Travel as much as possible. You think you don't like to travel? Do road trips. Do a road trip with some friends. Just spin a thing on a map and go to Denver or Nashville or Detroit or somewhere. Just go somewhere and take pictures. Take lots of pictures. Also keep a journal. should really keep a journal. It's very important. Even if you don't look at it again, take notes and keep a journal. And then, you know what? Because you come up with really great ideas, and then you totally forget about them. You go, oh, this would be so great. We should do this, or I should do this. And then later on, you find your note, and you go, oh, my God, why didn't I do that? I should have done this a long time ago. What was I thinking? Especially when you have those lucid moments after a couple of beers. You know, it's like, oh, I should do this, I should do that. Adopt an animal, if you can, or two, or three, or four, or five. Yeah, I think one of the biggest factors, I think, for anybody who's creative is self-confidence. And I think that's why those guys, the really successful guys, whatever success, you know, making billions of dollars, is that they have major egos. And I think that is to make up for the fact that they are insecure. So they overcompensate. But that's how our society is. That's capitalism. And think about big artists in Europe. They don't live in big mansions. They live modestly because it's about the work. It's not about the superstar, the movie star. We all want to be celebrities. Even now, our culture, the kids want to be celebrities. They propose to go to a prom on YouTube to make everything into, like, I want to be on TV. It's like, that's not what's important. But, you know, they don't listen.
Patty, thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
For coming in and participating
fun.
In the Living Legacy Project. I feel like this has been a really awesome opportunity to just, like, pick your brain and sort of, like, hear about some of your thoughts and your experiences. And
yeah.
I've really enjoyed all the different places this has gone.
NPR next. Right?
Yeah.
Oh, I know. Another piece of advice?
Yeah.
Whatever you do, if you're a writer or whatever you do, get an interview on NPR because... don't you learn so much?
Find out about everything.
Oh my God, I go out and buy the book the next day.
Yeah. Thank you for participating in the Living Legacy Project
at
the Birchfield Penny Arts Center.
It was a joy to be here.